Good afternoon, Your Honors. Pauletta Brown from Morris Nichols, Arshton Tunnel. I rise to introduce co-counsel from the Equal Justice Institute in Montgomery, Alabama, Mr. Brian Stevenson. Mr. Stevenson has been admitted pro hoc vice, and with the permission of the court, will be presenting the argument.
Welcome to the court, sir.
Thank you.
Ready to proceed?
May it please the court, my name is Brian Stevenson, and along with Pauletta Brown, I represent the appellate in this case, Donald Torres. I'd like to first again thank the court for permitting me to appear. Pro hoc vice. We made two arguments in the court below that we make in this court. The first argument is that a sentence of life imprisonment without parole imposed on a 14-year-old offender violates the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. The second argument that we make is that even if in some cases a sentence of life without parole could be imposed on a 14-year-old, the Constitution now compels an inquiry into the background circumstances and age of that offender before a mandatory sentence of life without parole can be imposed. Our argument rests in the Supreme Court's recent decision in Roper versus Simmons, where the court held for the first time that maturation, development, biology are relevant in the Eighth Amendment context with regard to sentencing. The court reversed its position taken in the late 1980s that the death penalty could be imposed on 16 and 17-year-old offenders and concluded that now the Constitution compels a different result and that no death sentence could be imposed on any 16 and 17-year-old. The implication in Roper was that while a sentence of life imprisonment without parole could constitutionally be imposed on a 16 and 17-year-old, there was also an implication that age is critically relevant when applying the ultimate sentence. And based on that determination, we contend that the sentence of life without parole, a sentence to die in prison, is no longer constitutionally acceptable for a 14-year-old. This court last year held in the Wallace case that a sentence of life without parole is appropriate or is constitutional in the plain error context involving a defendant who was 2 months shy of his 16th birthday, who was 15 years of age.
Now, your argument is under the United States Constitution.
That's correct. That's correct, because it's under the United States Constitution that we've had this new law development, which makes our case appropriate for a presentation to this court. And the argument, essentially, is that prior to Roper, the Supreme Court had not categorized anything about an offender that would change the analysis of a sentence with regard to Eighth Amendment thinking, so that typically in the life without parole context and the excessive sentencing cases, the court is always only focused on the offense and the sentence. In Roper, what the court does, however, is say, no, there is something distinct about juveniles that is relevant in the Eighth Amendment inquiry, and it's that distinction about juveniles when applied to the sentence of life without parole that we think makes this inquiry very distinct. In our papers below, in our papers here, we've made it very clear that we are talking just about offenders who are 14 years of age and younger. That's the principal distinction between this court's ruling in Wallace and the arguments that we make here. The constitutional analysis is very different for 14-year-olds. As we point out in our papers below and in this court, there is a very small number of children 14 years of age who've been condemned to die in prison. In only 18 other jurisdictions, can we find kids as young as 14 who've been sentenced to life without parole? That number actually compares favorably to the number of jurisdictions that the court concluded was insufficient to overcome an Eighth Amendment violation in the Atkins context, Atkins versus Virginia when the court dealt with mental retardation, or Roper versus Simmons when the court dealt with juveniles. In both of those cases, more than 20 jurisdictions still authorize these sentences. Here we're talking about less than 20, 18. Secondly, there are only a few dozen 14-year-olds in the country who've been sentenced to life without parole. Eighth Amendment scholars talk about the rule of 100, and explaining the United States Supreme Court's Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, tending to kind of find that the question of unusual typically means that in a broad universe we're talking about a very few sentences, typically under 100. That's what we're talking about here. Donald Torres is the only 14-year-old in the state of Delaware to be sentenced to life without parole. In the 20 years, nearly 20 years since his sentence, no 14-year-old has been sentenced to life without parole in this
state.
Is that
because there are just a fewer number of 14-year-olds who face that potential, or is it there are hundreds that face it, but only a very few receive it.
Well that's a really, I think, interesting question, Chief. We don't know entirely. We know that there are other 14-year-olds that have been adjudicated as adults with this kind of charge. We weren't given an opportunity for an evidentiary hearing. All we could assert was what we could determine without discovery into that question. It's a complicated question because the records aren't always obvious, but we certainly know that there are others.
Is it something that we would need to know to follow your analysis to its final point?
It's something that the court could certainly want to know, but I think there's no dispute that Donald Torres is the only 14-year-old, and given what we know about the rarity of this sentence in other jurisdictions, and we do know something about that universe, we do know that there are hundreds and hundreds of kids, even in this age group, that are charged with these serious offenses, and we know even among those hundreds nationwide, that is, we can look at the Bureau of Justice Statistics and get data nationwide, and we know from that universe that we're talking about a very small percentage of kids this age who have been sentenced to life without parole. And based on that, I think you can conclude that it's very, very rare, but there are these other opportunities to impose that sentence. Well, but that was one of the things that we could certainly explore.
Is that because there's discretion to do that?
Again, in very few states is there discretion. There is in some, but in very few states is there. Just like in Delaware, what happened was that the legislature lowered the minimum age for trying children as adults, subjected children to the adult system. We have these mandatory sentences of life without parole, and what we failed to do is to connect those two things. We haven't made a determination that life without parole is the appropriate punishment for 14-year-olds. We just lowered the minimum age, brought kids into the adult system, and then we prevented trial judges from exercising discretion that might adequately consider the age of the child, the background of the child, in making appropriate punishment. And that's why, under Thompson versus Oklahoma, we believe that this statute must fall, that this sentence is unconstitutional. In Thompson, the court was confronted with a very similar problem, a 15-year-old sentenced to death. And the court said, well, you know, we're concerned about this. We see it happens very rarely. There aren't a lot of these cases. But the way we're going to think about it is how many legislatures have expressly authorized the death penalty for a 15-year-old. Justice O'Connor's opinion in that decision was quite persuasive. And the court said no one had. And they said we're not going to allow states to impose this sentence where the legislature has failed to make an express decision authorizing this sentence for this crime. That's true in Delaware. That's true in all of these jurisdictions.
I know you've done a lot of research in this area, and you've talked about this rule of 100, and you're arguing for 14-year-olds. And now we've talked about Thompson and this 15-year-old. If we looked at the research for 15-year-olds, would we find something that's very different?
We would, yes. We would find a much bigger number of jurisdictions where those sentences have been imposed. We'd certainly be talking about more than 30 jurisdictions. We know that 42 states permit life without parole for juveniles. My understanding would be about 30 states that permit them for 15-year-olds. We're talking about several hundred 15-year-olds serving that sentence. So I think we would be dealing with a different empirical analysis, which the court does engage in when evaluating the Eighth Amendment question, than what we're talking about here. What's really interesting about the question of 14-year-olds is that in the law, both in Delaware and other states, we do give a special protections to 14-year-olds that we don't give to older teenagers. Even under Delaware law, we talk about 14 years of age and younger in the crime codes. A carjacking becomes an aggravated first-degree offense if the victim is 14 or younger. The death penalty statute talks about making a crime eligible for the death penalty if the victim is 14 years of age or younger. Sex crimes talk about 14 years of age or younger. Even in the juvenile code, 1147, there's language that distinguishes between a 14-year-old and a 15-year-old if you escape from a juvenile facility. A 15-year-old must be subject to an amenability hearing. A 14-year-old is not. And these extra protections recognize that there are distinctive things about 14-year-olds that merit a different legal inquiry. And that's what I think the Eighth Amendment analysis is particularly interested in. And when we look at this universe of only 70-some kids who have been sentenced to life without parole nationwide, actually worldwide, the United States is the only country in the world that authorizes or permits a sentence of death in prison for a child of 14, then I think that unusual analysis, that rarity analysis that the court has compelled in Roper, dictates a result that requires relief for Donald Torres.
Let's go back to your earlier point about I'll characterize it as a maturation analysis. If all these bright lines are being drawn for various reasons between 14 and 15, are you advocating that the line has to be drawn for Eighth Amendment purposes, or is this maturation issue something that says you must focus on the individual because there are circumstances under which a 14-year-old might be very mature for mm-hmm. that age, and then there are circumstances under which a 14-year-old may be more like a 10-year-old?
Yeah. We're making both arguments. My first argument is that I think that the line would exclude a sentence like life imprisonment without parole for any 14-year-old, and that's sort of what the court has done in Roper, in the cases where it has looked at age.
So that's where you want the bright line.
That's exactly right. I think at a minimum, the court would have to construct a rule that said you can't presume that a 14-year-old is like an adult, which is what happens here. The trial judge in this case couldn't give any mitigating effect to this really troubling history of abuse and despair, a very dysfunctional background. The young man was in quite a bit of turmoil, and none of that could have mitigating effect. And consequently, we'd be arguing both. But I think for the purposes of an Eighth Amendment inquiry, when you look at the handful of states that are authorizing these sentences and the absence of any jurisdiction that has said, yes, we believe that life without parole is an appropriate punishment for a 14-year-old, the nine jurisdictions which we cite in our reply brief that have considered what is the appropriate maximum sentence for a juvenile in the context of these cases, all nine jurisdictions have set the age above 14, all of them.
So what is the remedy that you are seeking here?
It would be sort of comparable to the remedy that the courts have imposed in other Eighth Amendment situations. It would basically require a sentence that would be parole eligible, that would give consideration to this mitigation. We're not arguing that the judge can't set some harsh sentence. We're not arguing that this young man can't be tried as an adult.
But could a life sentence with parole be?
I think it would be. I can't argue to you today that the Eighth Amendment analysis that applies in this context and requires this result would apply in that context and require a result that said that that's unconstitutional. Because what the courts have said is we want to recognize the possibility, the likelihood of change. And parole does that. And so I think, yes, a sentence of life with parole would satisfy the Eighth Amendment standards as we now understand them and see them using this evolving standards of decency in more than 35 states, you can have those kinds of sentences for kids this age.
So specifically, it's the ineligibility for parole that violates the Eighth Amendment.
That's right. And what the Nevada Supreme Court recognized when it dealt with this question and concluded that life without parole was an inappropriate punishment for a 14-year-old, and what the Kentucky Supreme Court recognized when they addressed this question, that this was an inappropriate punishment for a 14-year-old, is that this sentence does not contemplate, it makes change impossible. And we do not accept as a matter of biology and mental health and knowledge and experience that 14-year-olds will never change. You just cannot say that about a 14-year-old. You may say that about a 17-year-old.
Now, you can certainly understand you to say that 35 states would permit a life sentence with parole for a 14-year-old.
And that's just a guesstimate. I don't want to kind of tie myself to that. But we know that there are a lot more jurisdictions where a life sentence with parole would be permissible for a 14-year-old. My best estimate would be somewhere in the mid-30s. And my only point in making, the only point I'm trying to make is that when we look at what the court, the United States Supreme Court, has found necessary to conclude that something is outside the norm, we tend to look for jurisdictions less than 25. There are about 23 jurisdictions that permitted the death penalty for mentally retarded, 20 permitted the death penalty for juveniles, and some other contexts the court has looked for jurisdictions in that category. We're certainly in that category here. I can't argue, Justice Holland, that we'd be in that category if we were talking about a life sentence with parole.
What happens in states that have abolished parole?
Yeah, I think those are some, that's a really interesting question. Those are some of the states that have now pulled some of these 14-year-olds into this universe. Some states, like Louisiana, some states like California, have, even where they've said we're not going to have parole, exempted minors who are under a certain age. They've said that you have to be 16 in order to be subject to that kind of life with no parole sentence. You have to be a certain age.
Is that statutory, or
yes,
is that the Department of Corrections regulatory
process? That's statutory. There have been other states that have managed it through judicial litigation. In Kentucky and Nevada, the Supreme Court said, we're going to make a determination that this would violate the Eighth Amendment, and we conclude that such a sentence cannot be imposed on a juvenile or a young person under the age of 16 or a juvenile, a young person at the age of 14. But this construct, I think, is what I think pushes the analysis and where we have shown.
If a eligibility for parole passes constitutional muster and that parole is given by the executive branch, why would not eligibility for commutation cause this to pass constitutional muster? Because your client is eligible to seek a pardon and or commutation, correct?
Well, yes, you can make the application, but what the court has, that argument was made in the Roper context as well, and what the court has said, that the Eighth Amendment has an interest in punishment, and the punishment has to be consistent with the standards of decency. And so while, yes, people on death row could seek parole, and while, yes, mentally retarded people could seek commutation, the court has held that the Eighth Amendment requires more of jurisdictions than the mere possibility that through some executive function we might find an end run. And I think they root that in an understanding about the difficulty of executives and political figures of shielding the most hated people in our society. Let's face it, when you commit the kind of violent crimes that typically bring people into these proceedings, it becomes very hard to protect that person's rights, that minority right, in the context of a political process. And consequently, the court has held that the Eighth Amendment does require a baseline that would restrict certain kinds of punishments, even in the instance where there's the possibility of commutation and parole.
Did you want to save your time?
I would. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely, good afternoon. Paul Wallace on behalf of the State of Delaware, the appellee in this matter. I'd like to start just very briefly with the procedural background in this case because I think it's important, and it's important because Mr. Stevenson says the real change came in 2005 when Roper came to light. Rule 61, if that is the proper vehicle, only allows this court or the Superior Court to review one's case if the right is relied upon, is recognized for the first time after direct appeal.
Now, did you cross-appeal the judge's ruling on the bars not being applicable?
No, Your Honor.
Are you able to make this argument without a cross-appeal?
I believe we are, Your Honor. The as appellee, we are asking the court to affirm on grounds different than the court may have decided below. The problem in reality was the state never had a chance to respond and raise the procedural bars below because the court summarily dismissed the petition. But the importance is this, Your Honor. What Torres wants to say is we're here because the Supreme Court decided Roper in 2005 and that changed the landscape. It did not at all. Actually, Thompson is what gave him his relief because Thompson drew the only case, Eighth Amendment case, to draw that line in the class of juveniles that he wants drawn, or a line in a class of juveniles that he wants drawn. In fact, what happens is he's 20 years and three layers of post-conviction relief too late because Thompson is the case that said you cannot, as a matter of Eighth Amendment law, execute someone who is under 16. That was decided the year before he even committed this crime. That was available to him on direct appeal. Roper did nothing but move that line up. It moved the line up to 18. It expanded Thompson. That's what it really did. So Roper did nothing. It granted no new rights. It did not create a new rule applicable to Donald Torres. If that jurisprudence can be applied at all to Donald Torres, then it would be through Thompson. We'd suggest, here's the problem. This entire argument is crafted through a lens that is meant to look at death penalty cases, and death penalty cases are different. You may not hear it from that table very often when a prosecutor stands up, but death is different, and death is very different in this context. Because of the awful power that comes with the Eighth Amendment ability to execute, there is an entire body of law and Eighth Amendment jurisprudence that is so very different. It requires individualized sentencing. It requires that there be that special level of scrutiny. What is going on here? If we look at the two arguments that are made, and I'll take the second one first. If we look at the second argument that says that the Eighth Amendment commands that, in fact, there be an individualized sentencing decision, is the same argument made in Hammerlin and rejected in Hammerlin. In Hammerlin, what they wanted to do was expand the individualized capital sentencing jurisprudence to non-capital cases. The United States Supreme Court rejected that argument, and the state suggests it should be rejected here. Why? Because all of the statistics, for instance, if we took rarity, why is rarity important when you look at a death penalty context? Well, it's very important when you look at a death penalty context because there must be individualized sentencing, not just for juveniles, but for adults. And that's why, in fact, that special lens comes on to juveniles and that we must look at individualized sentencing. However, when we step away from the death penalty context, then we get into Hammerlin and we get into gross disproportionality. The first thing we look to is the crime. I might differ very much so with Mr. Stevenson about the statistics. In fact, 29 states permit a mandatory sentence of life without parole for adults and juveniles. 49 permit 14 and under folks to be prosecuted as adults. 44, and the federal government permits sentencing.
Under. Did you mean 14 to 18?
No, 49 states. A first-degree murderer can be tried as an adult.
Okay.
In 49 states. In 44 of those states and the federal government now permit sentencing of juveniles to life without parole. Permit. Don't mandate. Only 29 mandate it. And that's an important difference. See, they want to make the universe so small, and I'd suggest that they shouldn't try to make the universe so small. Of course, they have to. Because what they really want to get to in this court, what they really want to say is the Eighth Amendment prohibits a 14-year-old from ever being given life without parole. What they really want to say is no matter what a 14-year-old does, no matter how many people he kills, no matter whether or not the state is generally a consecutive sentencer or not, that somehow the judiciary has to create some arbitrary line that says that person will get parole. They don't tell us where that is. They don't tell us where parole eligibility would happen. And why is that important? Because what it does is it takes away from the public policy makers, people who determine sentencing.
What about the second level of that argument? Assume that is their first line of argument, that there should be a bright line rule. Everybody 14 should be eligible for parole. What about the argument that there ought to be individualized consideration of someone who's 14 to determine their level of maturation before one decides whether they are the one 14-year-old who gets life without benefit of probation or parole, or the person who gets life but subject to parole at various times in that sentence?
But
I would suggest that's
done at the front end through reverse amenability and determining whether or not, which really determines the person's competence even to be in an adult court, and that there is sufficient evidence, in fact, to hold them accountable for either murder.
Does it determine whether, given their level of maturation, they'll never change and for the society's protection, they need to be in prison without benefit of parole for the rest of their lives?
No, it does not, and it need not.
Well, isn't that one of the things that Mr. Stevenson's calling for us to consider is whether there's some constitutional prohibition against
making it
mandatory to all 14-year-olds?
That absolutely is their fallback position. If this court does not, in fact, determine that as a group, 14-year-olds are categorically opted out of life without parole sentences, if in fact that there are some, that the Eighth Amendment demands that there be individualized sentencing of someone who is 14 before life without parole is applied. The state suggests respectfully that again, comes from death penalty jurisprudence, not from normal Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, which is applicable in non-capital cases. and this is a non-capital case. In fact, what we should be looking at is Hammerlin. It is, by analogy, a Hammerlin argument, only in a different context. And the United States Supreme Court said that simply isn't required. And the Connecticut Supreme Court in the last week, in Carrasquillo, said the same thing. In fact, that argument was made. It was not a life without parole case. Instead, what it was a case in which a murder occurred and the sentence applicable to this person was a mandatory minimum. I believe it was 25 or 30 years. And his argument was Roper requires an individualized sentencing scheme for a juvenile, and it wasn't a 14-year-old, but for a juvenile prior to this minimum mandatory being given. The Connecticut Supreme Court had, in fact, rejected that argument, and the state suggests for good reason. It isn't required in non-capital sentencing. These sentences, the state suggests, are permissible.
I'd like you to help me also understand your procedural bar argument. Let's assume tomorrow the U.S. Supreme Court rules in a case exactly as the appellant wants us to rule in this case. And it's unconstitutional. The sentence becomes unconstitutional that was imposed in this case under the Eighth Amendment. What is the procedural remedy for Mr. Torres under that circumstance?
Well, if in fact, Your Honor, that's true, and if we agree that Rule 61 is applicable, then I-5 would be applicable. That would permit it, because that would in fact be a right relied upon that's been recognized for the first time, or what it would be is a retroactively applicable right, just as the death penalty was for juveniles. So if we assume that Rule 61 is the proper vehicle, I-1 or I-5, those bars would then be lifted. Our suggestion is that Roper isn't a new rule, not as it applies in this case. And in fact, I would suggest the Florida Court of Appeals and the Connecticut Supreme Court in Allen said as much when they were looking at this. I believe that the Florida Court of Appeals said it in Culpeper, a post-Roper case, applying the same type of procedural rule, a Rule 61 post-conviction type rule in that case. The reality is this. Life is a different sentence. And life does give, even a juvenile, it does not do what Roper prohibits may be done to juveniles, even if they are 14. His life is not extinguished, and he does have the potential to attain that mature understanding of his own humanity that they speak of in Roper, albeit in prison. It is not pleasant. There's no doubt. The state would suggest, in fact, that the reason for the rarity of these sentences is we don't see 14-year-olds who commit murder in the first degree. We just don't. I've been in the office since Donald Torres was tried. I can't think of another 13 or 14-year-old that we even charged with murder in the first degree, much less that has been convicted of murder in the first degree to have that sentence imposed. Luckily, thank goodness, we just don't see those cases that often. And so to try to say, well, there's only 73, thank goodness, there are only 73 people who we've had to make that determination committed such a heinous act. Many of the policy arguments that fall behind these Eighth Amendment arguments really aren't applicable here. There's no question as to the factual guilt or legal guilt of Donald Torres. He killed the Gott family. He did it intentionally. He poured kerosene in their house, and he incinerated an entire family, two parents, one of whom he watched come in and go back out and go in again, and two toddlers. You see, if Donald Torres is correct, where would we draw the line? Where, in fact, would the court craft a proper sentence for him? Because it couldn't be consecutive. If we went to the old rule where parole was eligible for him and parole eligibility was 45 years in the pre-TIS days, well, parole eligibility was determined after you put those 45 years consecutively, which means would be about 180 years, but actually parole eligibility would come in 55. But what Donald Torres would say is, I could be dead by the time 55 years rolls around, so the Eighth Amendment can't permit that. This court need not make that type of arbitrary judgment. The judgment as to the proper sentences in these cases is made through the legislature, and they have, just as dozens of legislatures in this state, in this country have. Again, it's not pleasant. But when a 14-year-old, like Donald Torres, makes a decision to do what he did, the law treats him as an adult. And the growing trend, just as the court noticed in Wallace, just as we suggest in our papers and as we suggest is very clear, permits adult treatment and permits life without parole. Donald Torres, unfortunately, is one of those rare people who has made that decision and who has shown himself to.
I take it your argument would be the same if the defendant was 10?
At 10, the chances of him being competent enough to be treated as an adult are probably slim. I mean, we begin to get into the line of where, in fact, someone is not even competent to be treated as an adult, the general rules of thumb. It would depend on the circumstances, probably, that we're seeing. In these, at very least, we know the Superior Court judge saw all the circumstances prior to determining amenability. He did have to determine that he stayed in adult court, mainly because of the nature of the crime, the fact that we have what's basically like a proof positive hearing and for burst amenability proceedings.
Help me understand what you were trying to describe. If he was eligible for parole for these four deaths, how would that work? How would that be commuted?
The way it would have to be computed, Your Honor, I don't know where it would be in the law books right now, because there is no such thing for murder in the first degree. But I am using the example of...
You mean no parole for murder in the first degree?
Yes, no parole for murder in the first... Well, there's no parole, period. But if we look to what a Class A felony, murder in the first degree was a Class A felony, it had up to life. If life was given, parole eligibility came at 45 years. He has four separate murder convictions. That means that parole eligibility computed on 180 years, which back then was about, I'd suggest it's about 55 to 60 years. So, in fact, he'd be 70 at the earliest of a possible parole. All of the things that we are concerned about these juveniles having, their greatest punishment really is when they're younger, isn't it? Those things have already passed. The concerns about having juveniles in prison and things like that, by the time they're 70, they get no benefit, really, to parole. I'm not saying that they wouldn't want it. But if this is driven by ensuring that juveniles aren't treated harshly, probably the harshest treatment, as far as their sentence is concerned, would come when they are of the juvenile age. So ensuring that, in fact, they have parole eligibility later gains them nothing in that public policy type argument.
Well, as I understood a variation on Mr. Stevenson's comments to this court, is that Roper was a little different to the extent it discussed the evidence that was proper to consider about the development of juveniles. And he relates that to his concern here that parole was not an option for the judge, that the sentence was mandatory. What's your reaction to that as far as it relates to the Eighth Amendment, that Roper's different when it talks about the type of evidence that's admissible, and that to the extent that evidence is admissible, the judge should be given under the Constitution some sentencing discretion?
Well, if I understand the court's question correctly, I think the argument was the evidence upon which they relied to find the Eighth Amendment violation, not evidence that's necessarily comes before a judge for sentencing purposes. Because in reality, if you look at Thompson and Roper, there really isn't a great deal of difference other than some of the psychosocial evidence. Actually, if you look at the psychosocial evidence, they don't draw those lines. They don't draw the same line that they want. They don't draw the line at 15. In fact, in large part, they speak about groups of juveniles. If you look at the statutes that they talk about that give greater protections or work statutes and things like that, 14 and 15-year-olds are generally the same under Delaware law in almost all circumstances. That's not something, of course, they'd like to admit, because Mr. Wallace, who the court decided the case on just last year, was 15 years old. But if you look hard at the scientific evidence, there is no great difference between a 14 and 15-year-old. Certainly not enough that we would draw a bright constitutional line to say the Eighth Amendment prohibits it for this class but permits it for this class. In fact, even one of the folks they cite, Dr. Guide from National Institute of Health, says we're not comfortable this is really applicable in, for instance, the judicial realm of trying to decide. If you try to draw those lines based on that science, some of the lines you'd have to draw would be, well, what about the fact that a 14-year-old female or a 13-year-old female has a more mature brain than a 13-year-old male? Do we then treat her differently as a matter of Eighth Amendment constitutional law? Should she be held more accountable? Certainly they don't. The problem is the science isn't nearly as clear that we could draw that type of line, nor is the law. In fact, the law, the state suggests, is much more on the state side as far as determining that these sentences are permitted by the Eighth Amendment. That law line cannot be drawn. It certainly isn't drawn by Roper. It certainly isn't drawn by all of the death penalty cases, which is what are really used to try to fashion this argument. This court would draw a line no other court has. Even Nevada Supreme Court didn't say that no 13-year-old could get life imprisonment. In fact, in Novarath, one of the things that the court ended up saying is that 12 or 13-year-olds may be subject to life imprisonment. This one wasn't. If you look at it, they had many more problems with the case.
How do you read what the Kentucky Supreme Court decided?
I think that is not as much the categorical approach as counsel would have us believe. By the way, in Workman, which was decided prior to this court's decision in Spence, and in fact, this court dispensed with Workman and said we don't believe that to be good law when we are determining this. So the state suggests that it also does not draw nearly the bright line it does. No other court has. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just quickly in rebuttal, let me start with your question, Justice Holland, and the question about Thompson and Roper. Thompson was a plurality opinion that in no way talked about the unique features of children as relevant to the Eighth Amendment question. And so Thompson does not establish a right that we could rely on. Roper, on the other hand, does something quite unique in Eighth Amendment jurisdiction. What it says is that in any category, age is relevant because of what we now know about maturation, what we now know about brain biology, what we now know about myelination and gray matter and white matter. We can't go back to Hamlin and Solemn versus Helm and say just because a sentence is death in prison rather than death by execution that age is not relevant. I don't think this court can conclude, and I don't think the state can argue, that the considerations of maturation and development are irrelevant in the context of life without parole. Consequently, Roper changed the dynamic. It then made the question relevant in cases like this case. So then the issue is, how is this sentence being applied? Does it meet the Eighth Amendment requirements with regard to frequency and broadness? And we contend that it does not. There is a profound difference between 18 states where you can find these young people, 72 people, and what you see in the 15-year-old category. 18 is consistent with what the court has held to be insufficient to establish the kind of broad support necessary to justify a finding of no Eighth Amendment violation. And you look at how many sentences have been imposed. The state is talking about, well, there are states where you can be tried, where there is no minimum age, and where we have a mandatory sentence of life without parole. That would make life without parole the appropriate sentence for a 10-year-old or 11-year-old.
Well, in this case, because Delaware is a state that requires sentences to be served consecutively, and we have four deaths, even if you prevail, and there had to be the possibility of parole, how under any scenario would your client get out of jail?
I think where the legislatures who have dealt with this question have, what they've done is they've constructed a remedy, a sentencing structure specific for these offenders that contemplates that they will change with age. So, for example, in Louisiana, what they have done is said, you become parole eligible at the age of 31. Doesn't mean you'll ever get parole. Doesn't mean that if your time in prison shows us that you're not evolving into the kind of person that made this a seriously tragic youthful mistake, that you're going to get released, but we're going to consider that at age 31.
That's a legislative determination. I mean, we're faced with a factual record where four people died, even if you were theoretically eligible for parole on one, you still have to contend with three other first-degree sentences.
Well, I think what this court would be required to do would be to conclude that this sentence cannot conform with the Eighth Amendment. And I think that the legislature would have the obligation to construct what remedies consistent with the Eighth Amendment would work for 14-year-old offenders.
It kills four people.
That's right. The offense would not dictate the sentence. We're going to have to consider the circumstances of the offender. We're going to have to look at that. Because, you know, a 10-year-old or 11-year-old could do what Donald Torres did in this case.
Well, are you suggesting, in response to Justice Holland's question, that as a part of reconstructing the sentence, we'd have to do something like order that the sentences had to be served at the same time?
In order to
conform to the Eighth Amendment?
Concurrent, not consecutive? Yeah. Well, what the U.S. Supreme Court typically does in this situation is strike down the sentence and leave to the state legislature. I see my time is up if I can complete this
answer.
Please
answer the question. Yeah.
Leave to the state legislature to fashion a remedy that is consistent with the constitutional proclamation. What we've tended to see in the kind of the rulemaking around this is jurisdictions fashioning remedies for these kinds of offenders that create parole eligibility at a certain age. And that's kind of disconnected from the construct of what typically happens for intentional murder. And if I could just make this one point quickly, and that's because the choice that the judge is making at the transfer decision, which is a choice that all of us have struggled with, which is what do we do with a young offender who is frankly too dangerous for the juvenile system, who we can't rely on that juvenile system to give adequate discipline and punishment? What do? We bring them into the adult system. But then we take away the discretion to give an appropriate sentence for that person based on his age, and we have to give them the adult sentence.
Well, but my question is, and it would be helpful to hear your answer, when you talk about that individual based on the age, the appropriate sentence, it's a much easier to focus on one 14-year-old who kills one person.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have four people, why doesn't that change the dynamic? Because we're not talking about one sentence. We're talking about four sentences.
Well, I guess because I don't think it necessarily turns. I mean, you could also have multiple felonies, right? Even in a single homicide, you can have collateral felonies that can create the same kind of problem. And so I don't think it's the fact that there are four homicides. I think it's the fact that we haven't adequately contemplated a sentencing structure for 14-year-olds consistent with the Eighth Amendment. And I think that would be the challenge for the judge or the legislature once we recognize that this scheme is not consistent with the Constitution. I see my time is up. There are no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.